So, my guest today.
No, my guest. God damn it. Don't you do that. This Andy. Is my show.
Andy, come on.
All right. Hi, I'm Andy Richter.
And I'm Jim Gaffigan, and this is Andy Asks Three Questions.
That is, oh, what a terrible title that would be.
Now, if you're unfamiliar with it, Andy, you know, so like we both come from Chicagoland,
yes.
But not really Chicago.
No, both, you are from a, like an idyll where you live is so close to the Indiana Dunes. It's a beautiful
yes,
place to
it
grow
is
up.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It is beautiful, but no one used to live there. Because it was a steel mill area.
Yeah.
So it was Rust Belt. So people used to drive from Chicago to Michigan.
Yeah.
Indiana was the road to Michigan.
Yeah, but I knew like some fancy people that had beautiful homes in the Indiana Dunes.
Yeah.
You just couldn't spend as much time. And the closer you got to Gary, the least time you wanted to spend
in
the
that's
water.
That's very racist.
You had to
you,
get a,
yeah, okay.
No, it's very anti-industrial.
All right, you don't like black people. Fine. Go ahead. Say it.
You're the one that went there.
So you're...
I love the Jackson family, and that's where they're from.
You know, you played me... You played my brother on
I
my
did,
show.
On your show.
A very similar kind of geographic upbringing you mm-hmm. and I had.
And we probably, when people want to make fun of us, they both do the same thing.
Yeah.
They do the
There's
same thing.
There's a Midwestern whining.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like John Malkovich
yeah,
is a whiner.
Exactly.
Too.
Although his seems classier just because he yes. went to Juilliard or wherever the fuck he went, whereas yeah. you and I.
I think he went to Southern Illinois, honestly.
Did he really?
I think so.
Carbondale. Oh, it was hard. It was probably hard to pull off that attitude in Carbondale.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. he was probably not as artistic back then.
Right, right. Well, yeah, no, hi.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good. There's a lot of Midwestern whining between the two of
there
us.
There certainly is. It's a right. why try kind of ethos.
There's a lot of...
Although you and I both,
anger.
You and I are both kind of, I think, examples of people that one might not think that guy should be in show business.
Right.
And yet we are both in show business.
Yes.
And I mean, bone crushingly successful.
Right.
Both of us.
I think of myself as ethnically a tourist. I look like a tourist and people treat me like a tourist.
I've yeah, lived right. in New York. No matter where you are. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always kind of looked like I'm visiting.
Yeah.
I'm very white bread. But you know what? That's not the end of the world.
Oh, no. Well, what are you going to do? You can't.
There's nothing
yeah,
you can't
Yeah, you
do
can't
about.
Crawl out of your own pale skin, you know?
No, you can't.
And I've always, I feel like as time has gone on, at least my attitude about feeling like a hayseed,
yeah.
like I can't do any, and I still, because I can, I dress like a toddler as much as I can,
right.
shorts and a t-shirt,
that
or I say, like Rosie O'Donnell on Vacation,
that's right.
sort of my wardrobe too.
Right.
But I am no longer intimidated going into fancy places being me,
right.
because fuck those people.
Right. And
yeah.
we were born in the wrong era.
Right.
We were in
what way?
I don't know. I just feel as though the doughy white guy, it peaked maybe 30 years ago.
Whoa. Oh, right. Don't worry. We're ruining. We're still going to ruin
oh,
the
no,
planet.
We're
don't
gonna,
worry.
No, we're going to ruin the planet.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we're fucking but, things up big time still.
You know,
good going,
I mean,
white
most
guys.
Of the senators look like us still. Mm-hmm. But that's...
Some of the female senators look yeah. like us. Yeah.
No, but not for that much longer.
Right. No, no, no.
It's over.
There's a demographic wave coming.
Right.
That will be able to, you know, like find the non-radioactive places and start encampments there after
right.
Whitey has
yeah.
ruined everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Tell me about your childhood in Chesterton. Tell me about your, you were one of many.
I was the youngest of six.
Of six. Now, were you treated as the baby or were you treated as an afterthought?
I think I was treated as the baby.
Yeah.
I don't have, like, the fragments of my memory are not, like, some people, do you remember most of your childhood?
I'm right there with you. There
okay.
is shit I just don't remember. I am not good at that. I don't know whether it was a coping mechanism to get over rough times.
Yeah.
But there's things like my brother talks about with absolute clarity
yeah.
that I'm like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah.
And there'll be stories about me that something I did and said and, you know, destroyed. And I don't remember that in the slightest.
It's so confusing for me because I also... being the youngest, like there's different kind of adjectives that are put in front of people, and I've always been kind of resistant to them. But I look at my children, because I have five children, and I, you know, my youngest, Patrick, looks very much like me. And I look exactly like my father, who looked exactly like his father. Like, the genes are very weird. So I look at Patrick, and I sometimes think, am I like that? Was I like that? Was I as funny and smart?
Yeah.
And I don't know, because then, you know, among my siblings, you're not going to get a straight answer right. from them.
No, they're going to bust your balls.
Yeah, I mean, even people that I went to college with kind of look at me like, I didn't know you were going to be a comedian. And I'm like, yeah, well, I was, you know, studying finance. It's hard to be that funny. But so like as a kid, but I know that I'm kind of a combination of a lot of things. Like I was born in Illinois. Raised until like the age of eight in Barrington.
That's a swanky suburb.
It was not as swanky then.
I'm sure.
Now it's much swankier.
It was kind of half rural then.
It was half rural. Yeah. It was a big commute for my dad to Chicago.
Yeah.
And so then we moved to Northwest Indiana, which is like, which is Rust Belt, which is working class, which was kind of a culture shock.
And was he still working in Chicago, taking the train?
No, he started working for a smaller bank in
Chesterton. I see.
In Northwest Indiana.
I see.
So I consider myself very much an Indiana person, mm-hmm. and I grew up on. You know, so where Rust Belt meets farmland. So there were many, you know, I went to parties in trailer parks, and I also went to, you know, parties, you know, where I sat on a bale of hay. You know, again, mm-hmm. but even hearing myself say that, you know, I don't want to exaggerate this. You know what I mean? It's like I grew up in the Rust Belt, but I grew up in a nice area.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I grew up around farmland, but it's not like I rode a tractor to school.
Right, right. And I'm in the same situation. And I did occasional farm work because kids could make money. I don't know if it was the same. You know, you could walk beans.
Oh, yeah. No, Orville Redenbacher was his plant was in Valpo, which was—
Yeah, Valparaiso.
You know. Yeah. And so— But it's interesting because I think of myself because, you know, as a comedian, as a writer, I'm always looking back and going, who am I? So, like, you know, I have, you know, I did collect beer cans. You know, like, there's things mm-hmm. that are definitely white trash. You know, like, the first, like, it was not completely a rural upbringing. Like, the first couple times I went fishing was when the community pool was converted into a pond. Like, they would just dump fish in there.
And it usually goes the other way.
And we would fish.
Wow.
So it's like—
Was it still meant for swimming, too?
No. It was like in October.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean it would change over seasonally?
Yeah, no, like, well, it wasn't—
Like, spring, it would become the pool again?
I don't know how often they did it. You know, I mean, I was fourth grade, and—
That can't be hygienic.
No, it's like, you know, you would fish where you used to swim.
Yeah.
They would dump fish in there.
Yeah, sure.
And you would fish them out. I don't know if you could eat them because
Were they catfish or trout or what?
I don't remember. All I know is that—
I'm doubting this whole story.
It's true.
I think it's a fabrication.
I was in the newspaper.
For what?
Because I caught the most fish.
Oh, really?
But I didn't remember
what kind of fish they were.
No, I couldn't tell you the difference between any type.
I feel like you've gone through your whole life not paying attention.
I wasn't paying attention that much.
Yeah.
So, but when I moved to Indiana, to Munster, that's when I was this true outsider. So that's where I had to develop my sense of humor.
Wait, to Munster from Chesterton?
No, I moved from Barrington to Munster.
To Munster. I thought you grew up in Chesterton.
I did grow up in Chesterton. We lived in Munster for a little bit, which is Northwest Indiana.
Okay,
and then Chesterton, which is closer to farmland.
Yeah.
And the Indiana Dunes.
Right.
Which is very beautiful.
It's beautiful there.
And people are discovering it now. But as I mentioned earlier, it's, you know, the fancy people in Chicago would have a house in Michigan. So they would drive through Indiana.
Like past up to Holland.
Because there were outlets. There were steel mills that, you know, let out supposedly cleaner water than they took in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but that's, so I grew up the youngest of six kids in a family that my father was the first one to go to college after generations of being in this country. So it was definitely success was associated with wearing a collared shirt.
And what did his sibling, I imagine he came from a big family too?
He was one of four boys from Springfield, Illinois.
Okay. That's a lot of my people are from Springfield.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And what did they do there?
My grandfather made dentures.
Oh, wow.
And my uncle, you know, they had different jobs. One of my uncles
just
also,
jobs.
No, but the story was that my grandparents, like there were a couple generations of like bar people.
Yeah.
Like people that that would work in a factory. Like supposedly the legend is we came over. We got stuck in steel mills in western Pennsylvania, and they escaped to coal mines in western Pennsylvania. And then they escaped because there were coal mines in Springfield.
There apparently certainly were, because a lot of my relatives were French coal miners that were transplanted into southern Illinois because it was strip mining.
Oh, wow.
So once there was no holes to crawl in. It was just rape the earth until all the coal was gone and then leave it all behind.
I say all this stuff, but I don't know how much some of this is almost kind of
half heard and half remembered.
Yeah. Half how I kind of want to romanticize it. It's, you know, because it's interesting particularly when you do interviews, even like doing stand up, and it's like the impact of, you know, people on, you know, being from Indiana and, Letterman was from Indiana, so everyone was like, "Letterman was your god," and I was like, "Yeah, I guess he was." And
sure,
so
then, if you want it, me.
Then
and
I started me. Saying it, and he was a huge influence.
Yeah,
but so was Bill Murray.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, I don't know what, you know, because then I'd read articles, and I'm like, I guess that's the truth.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Now within the group of your family,
yes.
When I said, were you the baby, like, were you taken care of by, say, like your female siblings and sort of looked after by your male siblings, or were you kind of
I was a bit of a whipping boy. I was a bit of a whipping boy.
Yeah.
I was the youngest of six. There were three blondes.
Uh-huh.
And three brown-haired kids.
Oh, and I bet the blondes were favored.
No. Blondes and the brown-haireds would fight. So my older sister, Pam, who also has kind of blonde hair.
Right.
She does have blonde hair, would be my protector.
Oh, sorry, Pam.
But I had my brother, Mike, who now lives in Florida, who's like a really sweet guy. But having a kid changed him.
Yeah.
My niece.
Because he was a real fucker before,
right?
He
was a monster.
Yeah.
He was a really scary dude. And again, I look at my kids and I see my older son, Jack, being mean. And I'm like, and I have like PTSD. I'm like, don't do that.
Yeah.
And so.
You'll make him a comedian.
You know, and so. But I think in my family, it was very. Like, my parents weren't exceptionally funny. My sisters weren't exceptionally funny. But humor was very important to gain favor with my brothers.
Yeah.
And so I was less of a competitor for food if I did my impression of my dad.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of that.
Yeah.
In my family. But it was, I think that my family, my dad aspired, he was very ambitious. He aspired to kind of be fancy, but, you know, it was overcompensating.
Yeah.
So my brother, Mike, the one who tortured me.
The oldest? Is he the oldest?
Yeah, he's the oldest. And the oldest boy, like right when he could, he bought a pickup truck. Like he was like, we're staying white trash. We're going, we're going to stay there.
I'll show you, Dad.
I'll show you. And so it's. But I also, what I love about stand-up is I also, you know, you can kind of, I think a lot of comedians have identity crises throughout their lives, but like the audience will tell you who you are. So when I started stand-up in New York City, I had no idea how Midwestern and white bread I was, but the audience told me, like I thought, oh, you know, growing up in this small town in Indiana, I was like, there was a mistake. I shouldn't be here. I should be in New York. And then I got to New York and they were like treating me like I was, you know, who I was.
Yeah, yeah. Like
which
a hick,
is,
yeah.
Which is
And you
like
think,
this Midwestern
oh, I'll
guy.
Be able to pass as just another another aspiring
artist.
Yeah, artist yeah. here in the big city, yeah. and they won't know. Whereas, you know, you might as well have be covered in cow shit.
Yes, yeah. absolutely. Or you know, maybe it's hayseed, but maybe it's just suburbanite. You know yeah. what I mean? It's you know, it's very kind of a white bread.
Thing, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting.
Like Dockers and golf shirt. Just right. Just the stamp of middle America.
Yeah.
Nothing exceptional, nothing worth even noticing.
And by the way, I would also say that all I wanted to do was get out of Indiana. And now I'm the biggest champion of it. Like, I'm very defensive of, because I've lived in New York for 30 years, and I feel like there is an overall condescension to the rest of the United States on the coast. I really do believe that.
Of course, it's just of course.
Every now and then I'll hear my friends say stuff, and I'm like, that is the most obnoxious thing yeah. you can say.
Although I will say, having lived on coasts for all myself, the parts of this country that are maligned, they ask for it in many, 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 many ways.
Yeah.
And I mean, yes, you can go there and there are artistic people, there are sensitive people, yeah. there are wonderful, supportive communities full of open-minded people, and then they pick Mike Pence as their fucking governor. So yeah. you know what I mean? It's like, yeah,
I would also
you know.
Say that, like, you know, New York City and Los Angeles, it's like, what do you go, 10 miles outside the city? You know what I mean? It's like 10 miles outside of West Hollywood and people are homophobic.
Oh, sure.
You know, what do you go, like, 10 miles outside of New York City and people are, you know, more likely to like Pence than yeah. to dislike him. So it's like there is something of, it's a strange, I don't know. I think it's a strange identity thing. And it is because I'm constantly touring and I'm in, you know, different communities all the time. I think it's less of, you know, and I changed my opinion on this. I think it's less about geography and it's a demographic breakup of wealth. You know, it's like no one wants to discuss the fact that it's inequality.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, that's why I'm running for president.
No, I definitely agree with you. And it's wealth inequality and it's racism and they are a two-headed snake.
Yeah.
And they are the engine of this country and have been forever. And there have been times through extenuating circumstances like World War II.
Yeah.
And all these young men coming back and our industries having been depleted, and there's this huge burst of economic growth and open-mindedness, and everybody's got a job, so everybody's kind of, you know, treating each other a little better.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually the rich got, you know, the teapot yeah. dome scandal just finds another way to get rich people richer and poor people poorer,
yeah.
and the fight between black and white people being the grease on those gears. You know,
I did some shows this summer in Central Europe and Prague and Budapest. And
a lot of porn coming out of there.
A lot of good porn, mm-hmm. right? No, but I was with my kids. And so what's
oh,
great
I'm ab- sorry.
What's so great about traveling with your kids is that you're kind of thrust to do educational things. Otherwise, I would just never leave.
No, I know what you mean.
But being exposed to like what happened 70 years ago in Central Europe. Like, we think of, like, the Germans. Oh, it was the Germans and the Nazis and Hitler. Mm-hmm. But when you're in Central Europe, you realize human beings are idiots that can be manipulated within a span of months.
And also brutal.
Brutal.
Fucking brutal creatures.
So brutal. Yeah. So brutal. And so when, you know, I guess what I'm taking away is that, like, the people in the Czech Republic or in Hungary that did horrible things, you know, like there was an underlying anti-Semitism. There was kind of, but like it was all motivated. Like we're just so impressionable. I mean, I even working in the entertainment industry, you know, I'm sure, you know, I don't even have to talk to you. And I know that there's at least once a week where you look at like some show getting press or some person getting press, and you're baffled.
Yeah.
You're like, what are you doing, you guys? Yeah, this is not good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's...
And whether it's quality or the quality of the person.
Or the
message. The quality of the work or the quality of the person.
Yeah. Yeah,
or the message of the work.
Or the message.
Yeah.
And it's just... I guess what my takeaway from Central Europe, and those people are amazing, is that humans overall are just idiots. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just like, we're moments away from like doing horrible things. And I, you know, like as a entertainer, I look at the zeitgeist. I'm like, all right, I have an Amazon special. I want people to watch it. How do I get them to watch it? And it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what motivates people or motivates the zeitgeist to, you know, a clean comedian who's talking about, it's like, there's nothing sexy or selly in that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing, but it's, that's not to say that I'm not continuing to try and figure it out. But it, I guess the larger point I'm getting to is humans are pretty scary.
Yeah.
So I don't think that, and maybe I'm kind of, I don't think that even people that have done horrible things, I think their crime is being human. Mm-hmm. Is that they're just not that bright, and that they're manipulated.
I also truly think one of the greatest sins is selfishness, is that when, as long as you just care about yourself,
yeah,
and that you don't place, and I, you know, and of course there's a balance. You can't be somebody that just lives for other people.
Yeah.
But selfishness is the root of almost all evil.
Yeah.
Is not thinking, not gracing someone next to you with the same humanity and need and worth as you do in yourself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, and I don't know what you do about that.
Right.
Other than be nice to them when they're babies. You know, that's really,
well, I think,
you know.
I think some of it is civics. I think it's like we have to, you know, we have to kind of instill this is how you.
Yeah. Behave.
Kind of, yeah. You know, it's, you have to build it into the fabric. I mean, it wasn't that long ago the standard protocol was rape and pillage.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you take over this town, let's rape and pillage. You know, there were some guys that are like, can I just do the pillage thing? I'm not crazy about the rape.
Yeah.
I just, you know,
seems
I've got
mean.
I got
seems
a girlfriend
a
now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just, I'm looking for a TV.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to rape.
Right, right, right. So when you get to high school, what do you like? Walk into the high school. What does the captain of the football team say when you walk by?
I went to a very unique high school.
In what sense?
There was only 100 students.
Oh, okay.
And it was...
Was it a Catholic?
It was a private Catholic school.
Okay.
But it was also... So there wasn't the John Hughes kind of...
Rebelliousness.
So in other words, everyone played sports, everyone was a nerd, everyone did everything.
I went to a small school too, and there was there was jocks and burnouts, and then kind of a middle, messy middle part
middle.
Where some kids played sports and got high a little bit, but
there was no
room for lots of differentiation into different groups. So I understand.
But I in high school. But also, I think that I think we're the same age. Are we the same age?
I'm 51.
22.
Oh, you drew me out.
No, but here's
how
the
old
thing.
Are you? Say it.
I'm 53.
Okay.
So here's what
Younger.
I also have this. I have this theory. When's your birthday, though?
October 28th.
All right, you're same age as me. So I have
what
this theory.
What does that mean?
I have this theory.
What is your birthday?
July 7th.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah. Still older. Yeah.
But I have this theory that.
Yeah.
There's the baby boomers, there's the Generation X, there's millennials, I believe that there was a very small, this is like totally arrogance, narcissism.
Self-aggrandizing,
that
we were special.
No.
60 to 68.
No.
What
no,
a crop
no,
of people.
I think, because the baby boom ended in 62.
Yeah.
Generation X started in, I don't know, 70 or whatever.
I know, and I'm in 66.
I'm 66, too, because I'm younger than you.
No, you're
not. But here's
so
the thing.
So bad with math.
But the thing
is
like the true materialism that took over America did not kick in until Dynasty. All right. I'm not a scientist. But like the you know
fucking
like,
Alexis Carrington is responsible for Donald Trump.
But like think about it. You grew up watching Happy Days, watching Laverne and Shirley.
Right. And all terrible shows when you look back at them.
But, yes, terrible shows. But kind of a romanticized notion.
Of the 50s.
Of the 50s.
Yeah.
And I think that had an influence on this microcosm of a generation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm talking out my ass. But so by the time I got to high school, I here's one of those things where I thought in high school – I thought all my classmates, I thought, oh, we're going to be senators. We're going to be congressmen. Like, I was delusional.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, oh, there's nothing we can't do. We're all going to do something.
Where do you think that came from? Is that from your dad's kind of grandiosity,
no,
you think?
Or? I think it was the headmaster we had.
Oh, really?
Who was very much, who would not survive in today's world because he was a yeller and he was kind of like, be the best you can be kind of guy. But I do think that in high school, here's the greatest lesson I learned. The greatest lesson I learned is I worked so hard through high school, so hard so that I could go to Georgetown, where my dad went, where he met my mom, where my brother, my Irish twin Joe went. He's a year ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get in. And it was like, that was like one of those, like there's moments of failure that kind of define you. You either go, all right, forget it, I'm giving up, or you kind of sit there and go, no, I'm not taking this.
Yeah.
And so I think in hindsight, I was like, no, I'm not taking this.
Yeah.
I'm not taking this. This is, I mean, I was very angry. I mean, I am very angry. Not as angry as you. I'm younger, and you're more angry.
Right, right. I'm very much more angry. But that's because I haven't had it as easy.
Yeah.
What was it about Georgetown? Was it grades? Was it just
I did horrible on my SATs.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I think I got like 10.
That's a shitty – that's a shitty part of that system is that the standardized testing isn't necessarily although in this case it might be reflective.
It might, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It might be a fucking bullseye in terms of capabilities. But at any rate, we all end up, you know, the churning froth spits us out where
we should
be.
I do think that like not that failure of again, this is like people deal with much worse things.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
But I feel like that failure, because in the entertainment industry, to pursue the entertainment industry, you have to be insane.
Uh-huh.
There's no practical scenario where you end up being the host on a television, the sidekick on a talk show that lasts for 20 years. There's no scenario.
For me, I think like in high school, if I had said, I'm going to be a comedy performer and I'm going to be on television for years and years.
Yeah.
I might as well have just, you know, said I was going to be Miss America.
Or I'm going to be
an astronaut. First man on Mars. Yeah. It was the phrase toot your own horn.
Yeah.
It was so toot your own horny that There's no way that was going to be possible.
You know, like no one in the entertainment industry in my town. There was the marching band. There wasn't even a theater department.
Yeah.
And so, but I often think of like, you know, here's what I do. Because, you know, now my kids are getting older and they are creative and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't, you know, it's like you want to say, hey, I'm a fluke. Like,
yeah.
I'm lucky. There's a lot of things that lined up. Some of it is just me, you know, never stop working, da-da-da. But it's luck.
Yeah.
And so, like, but I always bring this point up. It's like Dead Poets Society. I haven't seen it in a long time. But we watch the movie, and there's that father that's like, you're not going to be an actor. You're going to – and then the kid kills himself.
Yeah.
It's like at this point in my life, I'm like, you know what? That dad was right.
Oh, boy, I hope your wife listens to this. Get those kids out of there, Jeannie.
But, you know, like, I mean, look, the dad was right.
You know what I mean? Listen, first of all, First of all, your children, to say you want to work in a creative field does not mean you're going to be Celine Dion. It could mean you're somebody that works at the record label, or right. It means that you're somebody that, you know, plays cello on her records. You know, there's all, this is an industry. That was something that was like very formative to me when I first came to Los Angeles. Yeah. And it started having, well, I was making a living doing a show, but it was, you know, it was like a stage show and it wasn't much of a living. But I came out here and I remember one time, because I was here with a group of people from Chicago, and we drove out to the beach, and I remember looking at all the houses and thinking on the way to Malibu. And thinking, this can't be, like, every one of these houses can't be somebody that I know. You know what I mean? Like, of these houses have to belong to guys that hang lights or, you know, work at the studio or are somehow in distribution of records. You know, like, there's all kinds of ways to make a living in this business. Right. And, like, with my kids, they're going to do something creative, but I don't even – and it, you know what? If they work – I told my son, because he was having trouble getting his homework done this year, and he had other sort of like – but like there was one point where he was really just had trouble getting his homework done, and I was the same way. I had terrible ADHD or ADD, whichever one. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get homework done. And I mean, and I was smart, and if – you know, I – you know, my mother was not into scholastic shit. She did is she put a desk in the basement facing a blank wall.
Yeah.
Said, this is where you're going to do homework with the minimum of distraction. And I would sit there with a worksheet that would take me 10 minutes. And for 20 minutes, stare at the ceiling and then go, okay, come on, you got to do this. And then do like half a question and then feel like, you know, Frankenstein or like a vampire having garlic shoved in his face. Like, I can't do it, you know.
Right,
it was so puzzling to me. And then as time went on, what I ended up having to do, there was no – just – you just have to grind and make yourself do it.
Yeah.
And that was, I was trying to tell my son that. And there was one point where we had a conversation, and on one hand, I meant it. I told him, hey, look, if you're having trouble in your senior year of high school doing homework, maybe college isn't for you. Yeah. Because, you know, if you go to college, the homework there is going to be worse than your senior year of homework.
Yeah.
So if you can't do homework, maybe you just go get a job. It's fine with me. I'll love you either way.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And he told me later, like, when you told me that, it broke my heart. And I was like, yeah, it was supposed to. Like, it was. I was on purpose saying, honey, you can do this.
Yeah.
And if you really want to look at your choices, if you really want to narrow it down to simple problem solving, what are the things you can do?
Yeah.
That's one of your options. Yeah. And if you don't like that option, which you shouldn't like that option, although if you did, no big deal. Honestly, if my son said, I'm going to join the Coast Guard, great, be happy, do what you want.
Right.
But I wanted him to see, like, you know, like, this is definitely one option you could choose. And from all the complaining you're doing about the path you're on, if you look at another path, it's this one. You don't want that, right? Well, then you got to just buckle up.
It's so interesting, right? The whole idea of, because there's also
forming human beings and trying to help them.
It's insane because it's, ridiculous. You know, you said a couple of things there that are fascinating. One,
One,
it's just the detachment our parents had. Yeah. It was a different approach.
The shit that my parents never came to school.
No, yeah, no.
I was at school every 10 fucking minutes, it seemed, you know?
Yeah. And so, but the other thing is, it's like also, because I've discussed this with, you know, other comedians, is like, is it nature or nurture? So in other words, the work ethic, like I, you know, growing up, my father, we were essentially, I used to think like he just had kids so that he could have a yard crew.
Right, right.
You know, because he would just be like, why don't we move this mountain? Right,
right. It also might have been the sex.
Yeah.
The hot and sex with your mom.
But thank you. But he, I look back and I go, did I get my work ethic from that yard work?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. But So, like, in talking to one person in particular who's a dad also, he's like, it's, you don't have any control over it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have, if they see you work, maybe they'll pick mm-hmm. some of it up, but it's either in them or it's not in them. You can only kind of guide it so much.
Yeah.
And so there is that scenario of, you know, you got to do your own path. So, like, I, you know, as I brought up, you know, failing to get into the college that I wanted to go to, it's, I do think that everything along the path contributed to my success and my failures yeah. that I have right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So, what did Georgetown, what did it make you do? You said after Georgetown said no, you said,
I said, I'm going to get undeniable. I went to Purdue, which was a great school, mm-hmm. and I got straight A's.
Yeah.
And then they let me in. And so.
Wait, they let you, wait.
Georgetown let me in.
Oh, they did.
I transferred in.
Yeah. Oh, wow. From at what point?
So I transferred in my sophomore year.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's,
yeah.
That's really something.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. It happened a while ago.
I got to really rethink my whole Jim Gaffigan picture in my head.
No. And so, but it is, you know, it's terrifying as a parent.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you do? And also the point that you brought up, it's like you want to be honest and you want to give instruction. And I feel as though my children, they're just like, do you remember when dad said that? Like, I always picture them in a therapist office in yeah. 30 years. And then my dad, who yeah. was gone most weekends, said, said to me.
Yeah, but there's nothing. I mean, I know. All you can, you, I mean.
I'm going to be dead. It doesn't matter.
Right, exactly.
Right? It's just like.
Same with life insurance. Get rid of that life insurance right now.
It's like the
not
dad.
Not your problem.
The dad in Dead Poets Society was a good guy. He was a good guy.
Now, is that your model for fathering? Is that
what that is?
He's your fathering
model.
That is,
but I can't. He was
thin.
He was a thinner guy. I think he also played the dad on That 70s Show, didn't he? I don't know.
I don't remember.
I don't remember.
It's been a long time since I've seen that. Have a nerd look at it. You looked at you looked across the room at Will.
He could be a nerd. He's got three screens in front of him. How much more nerdy can you be?
Listen.
He looks like he's never talked to a woman before. Jim, that's sexist.
He has. He's married and they talk twice a year.
Yeah.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? All right, so after George, what do you study at Georgetown?
I studied finance.
Finance? Ugh. Why?
Yeah.
Did you have any aptitude or desire for that?
No, not really.
Oh, that sounds so gross.
And by the way, I think that looking back, I think my dad pretty much pressured me into it because
yeah.
I was the youngest of six and my siblings had gone to college and they graduated with these degrees in, you know, I don't know, like butter making, and they couldn't get jobs. So by the time
any other Georgetown
brother,
people,
my brother,
your
Joe,
older brother, oh, you're okay.
He went to Georgetown.
Yeah,
and so we were kind of the hardworking, kind of studious ones. I mean, my siblings all are very successful, but there was definitely a couple siblings that like would be gone for the first semester of college, and then they'd come back, and you'd be like, what happened? They're like, none of your business. And so, like, they essentially just went to college and just drank for 3 months and then came back, and my parents were like, you're not going. You know what I mean?
Oh, then they stopped.
Yeah.
Did you have
to? So then they would go at home, you know, or they
nearby.
Would, you know, or they pursued, but they all are very successful.
Yeah.
So I studied finance, and
yeah.
I hated it.
Yeah.
I graduated. I got, I got this job as a litigation consultant in Tampa, and because I love the beach.
Mm.
And so I'm in Tampa, miserable. I thought for sure once I got paid to do it, I would like it more.
Did you just look for jobs, or did you think I want to live in Florida?
No, I looked for
any job
was,
you could get.
It was
get
a very
and it just
cool
happened.
Kind of litigation consulting
ooh,
job.
Sounds sexy.
Where you would calculate claims for law cases. And so went there. I had like a crisis where I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like I remember I had a little recorder and I remember talking into the recorder going, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea.
How long does this take? How long are you there?
I was down there for a year.
Wow.
I did an episode of my TV show about that I would – watch TV. And then because I had, like, the day before I graduated college, I was with some friends at a bar, and I confided in this friend of mine. I told her, I go, you know, I just want to be an actor and a comedian. And she was, why don't you do that? And I'm like, everyone wants to be an actor and comedian. She goes, I don't. No, not everyone wants to be an actor and a comedian. And I'm like, you're lying. And I just assumed she was lying.
Right, right, right.
So then I got that job.
That's the ego that everybody who is a performer needs to have. Because everybody, no matter how scared they are or anything, their basic desire is everyone be quiet and sit in the dark and look and listen at me. Like, you know, listen to me and look at me. And that's like, if you have that in you, that's like a pretty big chunk of ego, you know?
Yeah, it's weird because I wasn't, I mean, I was definitely the class clown, but I was not somebody who enjoyed public speaking.
I mean, I kind of the same way, but I definitely felt like, oh, no, it's
you
worth.
You are me.
Very similar, obviously, but
we have the same prescription and glasses.
I don't know about that, but I definitely felt like I definitely felt like it's worth these people's time to be quiet and listen to what I have to say.
You know, it's so funny. You are so Midwestern, cynical, and like self-deprecating. And I know I'm describing myself.
Yeah,
but it is like it's self-flagellation. You do a lot of that.
Yeah.
Which is what I do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You are me. I am you. But the thing is, it's like,
I'm not sleeping with you.
You're not.
No, I won't.
I think I have sleep apnea. Let me talk to you about
I
something.
Know I do. I sleep with a machine.
You do?
I do.
See, I don't even care about myself.
My life got so much better. If you think you have it, try. Seriously.
I travel.
All you people out there.
All right.
They have little machines. They have little tiny machines.
Getting through TSA with that. I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, listen.
I think I have low T. I think I might have no T because I have no energy.
Go to the doctor. They draw your blood.
I'm not
going to
do that. I'm not some wimp. I tough it out and then I die. That's what a real man does. You don't go to the doctor and go, hey, give me some help.
That's what an idiot does.
The dad in Dead Poets
Society was right. That's what a man who's obviously painted himself into a five-child corner and wants out.
Those children will be my legacy. No, so what was I talking about before?
You were talking about
just
telling
hearing
this friend
your negativity. What is it about the Midwest? Like, there is, like, we love wallowing in this negativity.
Well, it's not everybody from the Midwest. It does. I once heard, I can't remember who it was. I think maybe it was John Belushi said that people in the Midwest, like the people on the opposite coast, want to get to the other coast. If you're in LA, you think you want to be in New York. Yeah. If you're in New York, you think you want to be in LA. Whereas people in Chicago, and he was saying Chicago specifically because they, you know, they talk about Chicago comedians.
Yeah.
That they're happy being there, that they're not really particularly, which I don't know if that's true because here we sit in Burbank, California, in a dark room
completely
with the air conditioning turned off.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is kind of a
sardonic.
Well, just sort
cynical.
Of a judgment about, like, making a big fuss. Look at you making a big fuss, drawing attention to yourself. Yeah. Mr. Big Shot, you know.
Well,
why don't you come over here and sit
Letterman,
with us and judge?
Think Letterman and Bill Murray have that very much.
Yeah.
That is, it's also kind
but
of.
But there's a touch of sociopathy to them, too, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but what, like, you're not a sociopath?
I'm not a sociopath at all.
You're not.
I'm truly not.
Why are you wearing a T-shirt that says, I kill babies?
Because it's John Galliano's new line, I kill babies.
All right. No, but I think there is kind of and I see it in my brothers because I think I'm a mixture of my brothers. Like my brother Mike, the evil one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
still the evil one.
Like there's a dark sensibility. And you've got that darkness. Like it's just a very cynical. Like we've learned over time to temper it.
Yeah,
but there are plenty of times where you say a joke. And in the past, people would look at you like, that is the worst thing you could say.
All the time.
And you're
when people want to do like a gross out or a or a you know, like, hey, yeah, let's, or yeah, like let's joke about something that you shouldn't joke about. I'm like, oh, you want to? Okay, here you go. Atomic bomb of hate and misery. Yes. And they go like, whoa, man, take it easy. It's like, hey, you started it. Yeah. You know.
So there is that there, and there's, but there is also, and this is me kind of patting us on the back, because I do think that Midwesterners, and I think Letterman encompasses this a lot, is like, I'll make fun of you, but you'll be in on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's an equality there.
Yeah.
There's not a hierarchy. That's why I'm not crazy about roasting, the roasting culture, which is fine. I don't have any judgment of it. But it's like, I would much more do that on a personal basis.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like among my siblings, the horrible things we say to each other.
Yeah.
Like my children, they're like, oh my God, did Uncle Joe just say that to Dad? Yeah. And they don't realize that that's how we show affection, because we don't know how to love.
Yeah, you can. That's a regional thing. Not knowing how to love. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's not at all anybody's fault.
Right.
Right.
But I think it's just this nihilism. There's just this, it's not going to get better.
Yeah, but I also do think that what happens is, too, is that whole thing about, oh, Mr. Big Shot, that's in yourself, too. That is, I think, somehow frequently a projected self-destructive urge of like, I'm a piece of shit. So, oh, you think you're so great.
Yeah.
But that can also, as you get healthy, manifest itself in a way that becomes a positive idea of, I'm no better than anybody else. And I deserve all the same things, whether they are good things or bad things, as anybody else does. And I think that is something that's kind of beautiful that happens to people from the Midwest, that I see less and less from people that don't come from the Midwest. I think that there's a kind of like a egalitarian.
Yes.
We're, you know, like, you know, Mr. Big Shot is also kind of like, hey, come on, we're all the same. So anyway.
No, that's fascinating.
How'd you get into college? Or I mean, how'd you get into comedy after college?
I
got to keep it moving.
I finally ended up, you know, I figured out, a friend helped me get a job in New York City working in advertising. And
copywriting?
I initially was an account guy, and then I was a copywriter.
Nice.
And
that's, if I hadn't done show business, I'd be in Chicago probably doing advertising.
Right.
Because there's so much advertising there.
Yeah.
And it's a fun industry, you know?
It's definitely from a distance. I mean, there is something about corporate America that is, it's pretty brutal.
I mean,
there's a reason I go on stage with a microphone by myself.
Yeah.
I love acting and I love the group mentality, but what is that, 6 weeks?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I'll work with someone for 6 weeks. Uh-huh. I don't care. And so, so then I got to New York. I worked in advertising and I had this fear of stage fright, of public speaking.
Yeah.
And so I took an improv class and then I was dared to do stand-up and I, you know, just it was amazing, an amazing experience. And and then my mother died. And so I was like, you know what? All the stuff that I was brought up with, like pursue a collared shirt, seek security, all these things, I was like, well, the only woman in the world that loved me just died, so none of this matters. I'm just going to pursue what I think I like, which is the entertainment industry and acting and stand-up. And so that, if my mother hadn't died, I don't think that I would have pursued it. I think I would have been like, what should I do next, Dad?
Yeah.
And because, like, life was so unfair in that moment— And
how old were you then?
I was probably 23.
Wow.
22.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, I've just been lied to. So then I was, rather than seeking security, rather than seeking the role of like play, you know, work till you're 65, play golf for 2 years and then die. I don't even play golf.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, all right, I'm going to find out what really makes me happy, and I'm going to pursue stand-up. And at that time, it was not the industry that it is now, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't comedian, like there was George Carlin doing theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was
and
it.
There wasn't sitcom deals.
No, there wasn't. Yeah. There wasn't really, it was totally a pie in the sky idea. So then I was like, all right, I'm going to be the weird uncle that lives in a dirty apartment in New York City.
Yeah.
And that's
everyone
what I'm
might thinks you might be gay.
Everyone thinks I'm gay. Everyone thinks I'm weird.
Yeah.
No, it was a very, but like, you know, the, again, the bravery compared to like, you know, people.
Sure.
Migrants.
Yeah.
Going
first
to
responders.
Country.
Or, yeah.
It's, but it was definitely, everyone I went to college with, everyone, you know, in my family was like, okay, that's
neat. Yeah.
Jimmy but is did, doing did you, his stand up.
Did thing. You get some of them that were like, secretly thrilled and envious?
Oh, yeah.
Because I felt that, too.
My brother Joe was, you know, he is very funny. And I bought him a class for at Second City. He lives in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And he couldn't go. And he and
couldn't
so,
go why?
Because he just didn't want to do it, I think.
Wow.
You know, he was also, he had a career that he was doing.
Yeah.
And so, like, there is something about... But again, all my brothers are very funny. And so it was one of those things where it seemed like, you know, I'm doing this. I don't care what you guys think.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you bring up the gay thing and it's like, you know, because people have to understand that, like, that even back then, there wasn't a certain homophobia associated with it. It was just otherness.
Yeah.
Like you were supposed to, the normal thing. Like I feel like culturally we've even... gotten to this point where we're open to, obviously, homosexuality is much more accepted now, but also being different is much more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even having long hair. I remember when my friend had a goatee and people were like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah,
like, we've come a long way.
Yeah. See, and that's one of the ways I think, too, where this small town people ask for it. You think like, oh no, they're not dumb and they're not stunted, but yet a guy walks in with a goatee and they have a fucking conniption.
Yeah.
I remember once in South Carolina, we stand by the beach with a friend of mine. He had long hair, he's Greek, long hair. It was on our way home when we stopped because we're going to drive through the night to get back to New York City. We stop in and we happen to know because it was the 4th of July week. It's the mayor of the town. Is sitting there at this restaurant eating dinner. My friend's driving his motorcycle back, so he has a leather jacket. You know, he just looked, he's a Greek guy with long hair. He walks in to the restaurant. The mayor from across the restaurant goes, what the hell is that? And it's like,
it's
he
like,
could be one of the fucking Oak Ridge boys. What the fuck are you talking? What the hell is that? It's guy with long hair, you dipshit, you know?
Yeah, no, it is. It's all.
The otherness is.
Walking tall.
Yeah.
It's everything is the walking tall.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think that's also, you know, you can find that in fancy places in New York City.
You're right.
You know? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm a great guy. But
you are a very great guy. Tell me about Jeannie, your wife. How did you guys meet?
We met at a Korean bodega. They're called Korean delis. I don't know what the term is now. In
well,
our
Korean
neighborhood.
Korean bodega is kind of like Korean taco stand.
Yeah, no, you know, well, I mean, the thing is it is a bodega, but they call them Korean delis.
Yes.
And I had met her. She's lived in my neighborhood, and I had seen her on the street. And then I didn't gain any confidence around women. I mean, obviously, I pursued women my entire life. But
Relentlessly.
Ugh. But I, you know, like in my early 30s, I was kind of like, all right, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so I had the confidence.
I think that's always been obvious.
Yeah.
You know what you're doing around the ladies.
And so then, so I had some confidence and I had dated some models and stuff like that.
Oh.
And so then.
Hand models?
Hand models.
Yeah. Nice.
And shoe models. And so then I had. Saw her in the Korean bodega, and I said, have I met you before? And she's like, you're so arrogant. We've met like three times, because I'm not that bright.
Right.
And so then...
And that sounds exactly like her, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
That's your relationship today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I'm just constantly in trouble. Like the amount, like I don't even, and then she'll be really sweet. She's like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, it doesn't matter. And then in trouble. And so we met there and we had a lot in common. Mm-hmm. And, but I don't.
And she's Catholic too. Yeah.
She's Catholic.
And was that a big deal?
That was like, I used to make fun of her. I lived across from this Catholic church. Never went in it for 15 years. Started dating this woman who ended up being my wife and then got married in that church. My kids were baptized in that church. I go there. It's like, I think that there's a joke also in like, because I know that, you know, hearing the Catholic thing is so absurd because.
Yeah. In show business, too. No, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It is. It's hard to have faith when you're in show business because it's such a. Especially comedy is tearing things down
just to
examine them, not necessarily to destroy them. Yeah, and cynicism, right? Yeah.
It's like the opposite of, like, you have to be cynical. You have to – groups are wrong.
Yeah.
I don't like groups. I really don't like groups.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like
– are tearing things apart to look at them and say, hey, check it out. Look at this thing.
And also you're saying things – there's a certain amount of shock. Mm-hmm. And you're saying shock and surprise. And so it is really interesting that I ended up marrying this Catholic girl and going to church and having kids.
Yeah.
And so it's weird because it is also very kind of personal because it's like, again, I look at my children and I'm kind of like, I don't know. Like, I didn't think when I was 32 that I would be going to church.
Yeah.
I didn't think that when I was 22.
Yeah.
You know, even in high school, I thought it was all bullshit. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? So it's like, but it's a very individual kind of thing.
But do you derive like real kind of sustenance from the spiritual faith aspect of it?
It
or
varies.
Is it more sort of like the, because I very much understand it because I used to go to church when I was a kid. And was always agnostic, but I liked the ritual of it. I liked the community of it. I liked the structure of it.
You know, it's really interesting because it's nothing like traveling for stand-up, but it is almost similar to traveling.
Like, in what sense?
In that, you know, I don't want to go. You know what I mean? I don't want to go to the airport.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, in the middle of my day.
Yeah.
But there is something, that's one of the things I do enjoy. I do enjoy being there with my children and like there's silence.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not paying attention.
Uh-huh.
I'm paying attention.
And it's pretty. Church is pretty,
and,
you know?
And there is kind of like, there's this time where almost kind of everything turns off.
Yeah.
And so there's this meditative kind of thing. But like my belief system, it's very individual and it's part of my own kind of journey, and like I need to have this kind of knowledge that I can be forgiven because like you, I you know, I have a lot of anger and self-frustration.
Sure.
And I'm, you know.
Both of us completely warranted.
Right. And so there is something of, but would I believe that I would embrace this religious structure that over the course of 1,000 or 2,000 years has done horrible things?
Yeah.
No, I never thought I would.
Yeah.
I never thought I would. But it's also, it's almost kind of like, as a comedian, I'm almost kind of like, the most irreverent thing I could do is do that.
Yeah.
And so, but I'm not, that's not the reason I'm doing it.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's so like the rebellious thing of being a comedian is going to church.
Yeah, it's weird. And it is, it's so fluid because there's times when I doubt it all.
Yeah.
You know, but then there's times when I'm like, thank God it's there. I mean, my wife almost died. And it's like, so like that, even the community there was like, I get it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I do think that I'm very much in touch with, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that human beings, like every generation, human beings think we have it all figured out.
Yeah.
We finally figured it out, folks. How we get rid of this sickness is we put leeches on them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, so I think that I want to be in touch with that, not only forgiveness, but with, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's, believe me, it's not this thing like, hey, you know, just in case. I'm not doing it like that. It's literally something that, you know, it's like I have friends that are in AA. And so it's like, I think of it as very similar to, it's a very personal thing, but it's just, I used to describe it like being a Cubs fan before they won a World Series. Like you would tell people you're Catholic and they'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Have you seen what's been happening?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's insane that you would do that.
You're like, oh, I'm committed.
You know, I got the jersey.
I got all the stuff.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, you know.
Got all the gear already.
And then, but, so I don't know. It's a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
It's like, I think I would give you a similar version of this answer every 5 months.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, there is also... but it's like, there's such, I mean, America has done horrible things,
you know, that
horrible things. And so I'm still American. Yeah.
Everybody picks and chooses what they take out of an institution.
Yeah.
Nobody is like 100% because you just can't, because
it's just,
there's too much of good and bad and everything. Do you mind talking a little bit about when Jeannie got sick?
Not at all.
Tell people.
Well, I should point out that Jeannie is writing a book going to be coming out in October all about this.
Yeah.
You know, of course, Jeannie, this woman who's like a superwoman. She's the mother of five.
She's a force in nature, yeah.
Executive producer of this show we did and all this. She gets done with a life-threatening brain tumor that's on, you know, her, you know, enmeshed in her cranial nerves on her spine. And the first thing she does when she, you know, can walk is she starts writing a book. And you're like, you can take a break.
Yeah.
You know
what I mean? Yeah.
And so, but it was really terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, because again,
She started having symptoms.
It was, she had hard of hearing and she was at a pediatrician's visit with our five kids. I was probably out doing a show somewhere.
Right, right.
And the pediatrician, who's this amazing doctor, said, you should get that hearing checked. Like, Jeannie just was like, I'm exhausted. I have five kids.
Yeah.
And she goes, nah, that's a little weird. So she went to a ENT and eventually got an MRI, just a routine, kind of like, we're just going to check. And then they saw this growth the size of a pear.
Wow.
On her brainstem.
It's always fruit.
It's always fruit,
it's
yeah.
It's always fruit.
It's always fruit, yeah. Right? But before you knew it, it's like we're sitting in this brain surgeon's office, and he's describing
these scenarios. Brain surgeon.
Oh,
I thought you would ever go to a fucking brain surgeon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You're just like so grateful that someone likes science.
Yeah.
You're like, thank you. For liking science, because I
thank you, nerd. I think you owe Will an apology.
I think I do owe an apology. And so then, I mean, there were a lot of hiccups along the way, but there was. So she had the brain surgery; she had it removed. So there's like this 12-hour surgery.
Yeah.
And so I'm just walking around the reservoir in Central Park, and so then I come back, and they wake her up because there's scenarios where they're like. You're like, sometimes people walk out of the hospital the next day. Sometimes people die. And you're like, okay.
Thanks.
Okay. And so she went through the surgery. They woke up. She woke up and she had all these tubes in her throat. And it's like there was a possibility of facial paralysis, you know, hearing completely lost, speech impediment, all these things. Brain damage, whatever. And so she woke up and, you know, like she could mouth, you know, like, oh, who are you? What year is it? You know, it's interesting because they're like, who's the president? And she's like, and she shook her head, Trump. And, you know, it's like, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And some of the muscle memory of, I know nothing about brains, but they removed this breathing thing. That was down her throat and to see if she could breathe on her own. And so she was breathing on her own, but the swallowing wasn't working. So then she aspirated. So all this liquid went into her lungs and then she got pneumonia, like really bad pneumonia. And the doctor was very nervous. And that's when the brain surgeon's nervous.
Cause
they're, you know, everyone that works in a hospital, they have like, they have their very serious face.
Thousand-yard like, stare, yeah.
And he was like, oh. And I was like, oh, fuck. This is a day or two later. Yeah. And so it was like, and I'm updating everyone doing these emails. And I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to be a single father of five children.
Wow.
And I can't
even. With a road career.
Well, it would be, I would just obviously.
Have to figure something
out. I'd have
to
give it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, okay. So I was like, all right, this is, you know, I got to do my career. This is what fate is giving me. Then it was very touch and go for a while. And so it was like one of those things where she, you know, she got a tracheotomy and then she had a feeding tube and it was like she couldn't talk. She couldn't eat for like 3 weeks.
Wow.
And she had to be married to me. who talks.
Which is the real hill to climb.
And thinks only, pretty much only about
sure, food. Right.
And so.
Is inconvenient, Jeannie.
But there was, I did this special Noble Ape about all of, you know, a portion of it's all about that medical thing. But it was really interesting seeing, because then I started touring doing this material, because when she got out of the woods, she was like, go. And
Had she had enough of you at that point?
She had had enough of me. But it was one of those things where I think we live in a certain amount of denial about our mortality, obviously. But we also dip into this. You know, yeah. We have parents, loved ones, friends that go into the hospital, die, almost die. And we have kind of like this, oh, wow, this is a really, these are the important things in our mm-hmm. lives. And then 2 weeks later, we're yelling.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. So, but she's doing a lot better, but she's still, you know, it's like her leg's tingly. She's had a second surgery. She had to delay the recording of her book because the surgery that they did, because like one of the vocal cords is just done. And so they had to rebuild her vocal cords. It's an ongoing thing. It's wow. not like, you know, spraining an ankle.
Yeah. Are her motor skills okay?
I mean, they're good. Pretty much, I mean, yeah. She's definitely, there's times when, like, her energy's come back a lot. I mean, she has more energy than me because I have low T.
Sure.
Or no T.
Well, there's no way to know.
And, you know, like, there's certain things, like, we're swimming in the ocean and there's waves. And I'm like, you can't do that because it's like, there's a other aspect of like she has these veins that are very fragile in her neck. And oh, all wow. Stuff. So,
wow.
It's heavy stuff.
Yeah. It's got to be. And especially with five kids.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just.
And especially since I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. I remember when I was on your show playing your brother and we were on the set of your apartment, which you told me was. And it was a one-bedroom apartment or a two-bedroom apartment?
It was a two-bedroom.
Two-bedroom apartment. And you told me, and it was a little set.
Yeah.
It was a little apartment. And you told me it was slightly larger.
No, they had to make it bigger so that
they could
be
shoot.
Cameras.
Yeah. And I was in air quotes, kid's bedroom. And I was like, five fucking kids in an apartment like this. And you said, yeah, we were very irresponsible. Like, we made bad decisions. And I mean, it's. What I mean, do you think there was a drive to have to replace the five that you grew up with? Or
no, well, some of it
did you just not think and you just like, yeah, let's have another one.
Well, it's some of it was some of it there was, to be fair, there was this romantic notion of she comes from a big family, I come from a big family. But I wasn't
did as you were told.
I did as what I was told.
Yeah, I understand.
But I also was, you know, so like the second kid's really hard.
Yeah.
And then the third kid's really hard.
Yeah.
And then at that point,
the fourth and fifth are like, yeah.
I was like, I have no energy.
Sure.
And my whole thing, and I wrote that book, Dad is Fat. It's all about like, can I afford a decent hamburger here and there?
Yeah.
That's in the end, that's all I care about.
Sure.
And you know, there is, they do provide so much joy and all that stuff that parents say.
Yeah. No, I mean, they are the most you know, they make everything else seem really stupid.
Right.
Which is the best thing that they do is
and
they make
it terrifying.
All this shit that you've your whole life, like work kind of things or career things that you've been really worried about and really stressed out about. And you have these kids and you're like, oh my God, that stuff is so dumb.
So stupid.
So pointless and so stupid and so laughable.
Yeah.
And I can go in, now I can go into meetings about things that are very, very important and just be like, well, fuck this. Who cares, you know?
Yeah. No, it's weird. I turned down a movie because last week I was with my family. We go to this island where there's no cars and it's like just kind of like everybody kind of takes golf carts everywhere.
Yeah.
And
is it in Michigan?
No, it's in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And you have to rent a house and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so then I got this small part in this really cool movie and I was like, I can't do it. I got to do this. And they're like the directors and the producers were like, no, really, this is, you want to do this. And I'm like, no, you know, like.
I'm on vacation.
I'm, you know, this is like, I'll give up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'll, you know, I didn't get any sleep last night. But, you know, it's like, there's certain things like, I imagine the kids will go, I remember doing that one week where we would go to the beach house.
Right, exactly.
So I kind of protect that.
Yeah. Now, speaking of movies, you have quite the star turn. You have a movie coming out called American Dreamer.
Yes.
And you are the star of it in like a way that I don't have you ever done anything similar? I mean, because this is purely a dramatic role of a guy really on the edge.
Yes. I mapped the character on you, Andy.
I can see that.
No, but I mean,
most people that know me are fascinated by me.
Right?
Absolutely. They think about not much else but me.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it was an amazing opportunity. I do love acting.
Yeah.
I love
How did it come to you? Did the director have you in mind or
I think it was a casting director, Mary Verneau, who's been very good to me. She pitched me for Chappaquiddick, she pitched me for a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read the script. I loved it. And, you know, selfishly, part of me, I want to show people what I can do because I want directors and producers to
go,
he can act.
Absolutely.
And so, but I love the story. I love
And people love to tell you as a comedian, oh, gosh, you can act. And it's like, well, yeah no shit, man. You're paying me to, you know.
Well, and it's not as if that skill isn't used in comedy.
Yeah, it's not like, oh my God, you're also a world-class fencer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're fairly close.
It's nice.
You know, they're right next door to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so but I love the role and there's dark sides, you know? It's like, I'm sure when you watched American Dreamer, you were like, this guy's, his story is, I think the movie's really about white entitlement. Like, I think that's this guy.
Absolutely.
He's had some, you know, there are people that are rideshare drivers because they do it as kind of a side job.
Side gig, yeah.
They do it as something to get going, so they're going to school. And then there's some people that do it because their life has fallen apart. And I play one of these guys, his life has fallen apart. And you kind of track that as the movie goes on, you learn more and more about this guy. And initially, and that's so fun, you know, to like build where you know people are watching and maybe they're like on his side so that later on they can, you know, similar to comedy, there's a surprise of like, oh, I shouldn't have assumed that this guy was this way or that.
Yes.
And it
because
was,
just for people in the movie, you also are, in addition to being a rideshare driver, you are kind of like the personal driver for a drug dealer.
Yes.
And then you kind of get sucked into, because of financial hardship.
Yes.
And a little bit of mental illness, too. You get sucked into criminal behavior.
Yes.
And it all goes horribly wrong.
It goes, And it's
It's very tense. It's very taut, you know, like.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like having a meal with you.
Oh, well, thank
Kaboom!
You. Hey, that.
Yeah.
But I, you don't know with these, this film was, you know, I think we shot it in like 17 days.
Uh-huh. Where at, by the way?
In Norfolk, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great, so like there were kids from Old Dominion,
mm-hmm.
like part of the university, like they used their cameras, and this director was great. He's doing a movie with Russell Crowe. He's like taking off, and a great cast. But it was one of those indie movies where there, you know, like there's no budget.
Yeah.
There's no budget.
Yeah.
And so there, I remember the first day of shooting, they showed me to a room that had no chair. It was just like, there was, I think it was like.
That was going to be like your room to hang out in.
Like, and I was like, can I get a chair? And they're like, oh yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you're like, you're like, I just, you know, I.
Just go stand in the corner like a robot.
Yeah, no, down. Like, yeah. It's like, do you think people, you know, but you know, they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of those things where that's that level of, and it was all night shoot. So it was crazy. You get done at 6 in the morning.
Yeah. And your whole, you're like,
I don't know what to do.
Weeks, yeah.
And so,
you're great in it.
Oh, well, thank you.
You know, and you're probably going to get an Oscar.
I think I'm going to get
two. Yeah, absolutely.
Not
for acting, but for something.
You're talking about an Oscar the Grouch. I'm going to get an Oscar the Grouch doll.
An Oscar Mayer wiener.
Yes.
All right, well, let's get to the what you've learned part.
Okay.
I mean, what's you know, what's on Jim Gaffigan's tombstone? What does Jim Gaffigan want to pass on to his kids?
I think what I've learned is, I think I've learned that being angry and complaining, which I indulge in, serves no purpose.
Mm-hmm. Except material.
Yeah. Well, I think some of the, you know, so there is the anger that bumps me on an idea that ends up being material.
Sure. That fuels your work. Yeah.
But like the frustration of like the first 7 years I did stand up, I felt like there was just, I couldn't get a break.
Yeah.
I don't think that was productive. I also think that assuming that. One of the things I learned is that roughly 80% of people that have jobs are bad at them.
Mm.
And that's not to be kind of mean, but if you assume.
It's just the way it works.
You just assume they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, like, you don't, I mean, which sounds kind of jerky, but it's more of like, don't assume that this person who's going to do this knows what they're doing.
Right. I came from a bunch of family businesses that their business model seemed to be putting out fires. There was no thinking ahead. There was just kind of like, we'll show up and open the store and, oh shit, something happened and deal with it.
Yeah.
And I just assumed when I got out into the big adult world that no, there would be smooth, sophisticated people that really had a plan. No, it's all the same. It's just everybody going to work and sitting there quietly until something happens and then going, oh, fuck, I got to figure this out. Yeah. And it's like, okay, I don't know why I thought any different. Like why I would think that like what these family members were doing would be any different than what people at a movie studio were doing.
Well, that's the thing that I think, you know, there's all these moments of looking behind the curtain. That moment in The Wizard of Oz where you're like, oh, there is no Oz. That's all the entertainment industry. It's like, but, you know, like, and I'm not bashing the Montreal Comedy Festival, but like when I was starting as a comedian, I just wanted to get to the Montreal Comedy Festival. And then I got there and I'm like, oh, it's just a bunch of comedians.
Yeah.
And so, but like, I feel like the entertainment industry, it's like, I'm very excited about all the opportunities I've had and stand up and, but, you know, I have this new special on Amazon, but, you know, so I was like, I'm going to be the first special on Amazon. They're probably going to have a parade for me. And do you know what I mean? It's like the press releases Amazon's first original. And the reality is it's an enormous corporation.
Yeah.
The biggest corporation
in the world. They got a gazillion things going on.
They don't care.
Yeah.
Now, are they going to promote it? Yes. But like, so like, oh, it's I always naively think that you're going to achieve something And then you'll be metaphorically escorted into a room of luxury.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist. Mm-mm. So I keep learning that over and over again. It's like, once I get this, I won't ever have to deal with a heckler, or I won't.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the other thing I've learned, is that I do like surprises. That I think being a comedian, I like being on stage. I like the fact that there's a risk of utter humiliation. I like that.
Yeah.
I like the, I mean, it's stacked. I'm holding a microphone. You know, I have my bag of tricks. Yeah. I have jokes. But I like the risk. I like the endorphin rush. I've learned that I need to seek creative fulfillment as opposed to, you know, other people's idea of success. Like, I think it took me a long time.
Or to notoriety, realize. Like, you know, like being famous or something.
Yeah. Like the whole idea, like every time there's an article about me in stand-up, I always kind of like get mad at myself for reading it, because it's always kind of like, there's nothing sexy about what I do, but people come and see it.
Yeah.
So like when some New York Times writer is writing about me, he's just like, I don't know. He's just like, he does a lot of jokes that people like. And I'm like, yeah, that's the idea.
That's
what it's supposed to be.
He makes people feel good.
You know what I mean? You know, people come and they
get happy.
You know what I mean? As opposed to like, you know, me reinventing. Like, I'm essentially doing exactly what a comedian's supposed to do.
Yeah.
They describe it as conventional. Like, that's a negative thing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? But getting caught up in other people's expectations is always a waste of time.
Yeah.
And I remember even when I started, people were like, why don't you go on The Tonight Show? And I'm like, it's not like I haven't thought of that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Have you thought of going on Conan Show?
Oh, yeah.
I thought of it.
Yeah.
Also, the thing that I've learned is that there's so much I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm just going to continue to not know more and more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that I'm good in bed and I have a huge penis.
And you're younger than me.
And I'm younger than you.
You got that going for you. That's probably probably one of the things that really fuels your sexual prowess.
Yeah.
Is knowing you're younger than me.
But you know what? If I didn't have low T or no T.
Sure. Probably it would be dangerous for women.
It would be
for you.
Yeah. I didn't even bring it with me.
Oh, didn't bring what? Your penis?
No, it's out playing pool. I don't know what it's doing.
Playing pool. Now that I would like to see.
Right?
Well, Jim, thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
And quite seriously, I am so glad to know you and to have gotten to know you over the years and to count you as a friend and to. And like when you asked me to be on your show and play your brother, it was very meaningful to me. And, I was very touched by that, you know.
Well, I do feel like we're related.
So. I know it was Jeannie's idea.
No, it was totally my idea. It was totally my idea.
All right. Well, God bless you.
Thank you, buddy.
And keep doing what you're doing.
Appreciate it.
And more. And good luck with the movie and the new special. And give my love to Jeannie.
I will.
Thanks. Not those goddamn kids, though.
Not them.
All right, listeners, thank you. We'll see you next time on The Three Questions with me. I forget my name.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Becton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.